Now, if somebody was to stand up in a Christian meeting that you were at one day and was to say, right, tonight I'm going to talk to you about how God saved me, you wouldn't know exactly what was coming, would you? On the one hand, that man might take you back to the life and death and resurrection of Jesus 2,000 years ago. He might say, that is how God saved me, by sending his son to deal with my sin. On the other hand, he might take you back to his own life story and to the great transformation that has occurred in his life from what he used to be to what he now is. And he might say, that is how God saved me. He saved me by turning my life upside down and making me a disciple. Now, either of those would be legitimate, wouldn't it? If the man pursued that first line of thought, he wouldn't be spreading any heresy. If, on the other hand, he pursued that second line of thought, he wouldn't in any way be distorting the gospel. Because the fact is, those are two distinct aspects of salvation as the Bible describes it. And they are complementary aspects. So that really the second is, I suppose, the application, isn't it, of the first. Life transformation must be based upon the cross and resurrection of Jesus 2,000 years ago. But then on the other hand, the cross and resurrection of Jesus 2,000 years ago must be outworked in life transformation. So these are two complementary aspects of this one concept of salvation which the Bible portrays. Well, over three Wednesday evenings, tonight, and then there's a bit of a gap, and two further Wednesday evenings in the second half of May, we're going to consider the second aspect of salvation as the Bible portrays it. And we're going to do so by working through a very familiar New Testament passage. It's Ephesians chapter 2 and the first 10 verses of that chapter. And in our first session then tonight, we shall think about the context of salvation. That's in verses 1 to 3. In our second session, we shall think about the experience of salvation. That's verses 4 to 7. And in our third session, we shall think about the author of salvation. That's verses 8 to 10. But remembering then, in each case, we're talking about salvation in terms of that second aspect, the life transformation aspect of salvation. Well, let me read then verses 1 to 3 that we're considering this evening. Paul writes, "As for you, you were dead in your transgressions and sins, in which you used to live when you followed the ways of this world and of the ruler of the kingdom of the air, the spirit who is now at work in those who are disobedient. All of us also lived among them at one time, gratifying the cravings of our sinful nature and following its desires and thoughts. Like the rest, we were by nature objects of wrath." And you can probably see already then why I've entitled this evening's session The Context of Salvation. If your daughter comes home from school one day and says to you, "I'm so grateful to my teacher, Mr. Jones, he saved me today," you don't immediately know what significance to attach to those words, do you? It could be that your daughter is painfully shy, and strictly speaking, it was her turn to read out a poem in class that day, but Mr. Jones, sensing her real discomfort, said that somebody else could read out the poem instead of her. In which case, "he saved me" is, I suppose, it has a mild significance. The claim, "he saved me," in that instance. But then again, it could be that your daughter that day, she was in the playground at lunchtime, And a much older and beefier girl was about to beat the living daylights out of her. But Mr. Jones came along, and he came along just at the right moment, and he dealt with the bully who was about to attack her. Well, in that case, the claim, "He saved me," has quite a bit more significance, doesn't it? It really is quite significant in that instance. But then again, it could be that your daughter has been on a school trip that day to the zoo. And there at the zoo, a 30-foot crocodile has managed to escape and was just about to eat your daughter, but Mr. Jones came along and whisked her away from the jaws of that beast. In which case, the claim, "He saved me," is very, very significant indeed. So you see that the claim has to be placed in some kind of context, doesn't it? If it's really going to be understood and if the right significance is going to be attached to it. And similarly then, when the Bible says that we, as Christians, are saved people, what does that mean? How significant is that? Is it mildly significant? Is it really quite significant? Or is it very significant indeed? Well, in these first three verses of the chapter, Paul is giving us a context which will enable us to answer that question. He's saying in these three verses, this is what we have been saved from. This is what we were pre-salvation. This is the situation, this is the problem, this is the predicament which our salvation addresses. And there are four elements to it. First of all then, we were dead. We were dead. He begins, "As for you, you were dead in your transgressions and sins in which you used to live." Now, when Paul refers here to transgressions and sins, he's not talking about two essentially different realities. He's merely describing the same reality in two slightly different ways. The word transgressions contains the idea of stepping over a boundary. When you go to one of these National Trust properties, you know how you can go into many of the rooms in the house or mansion or whatever it is, or at least you can go so far into them. But quite often you'll find that halfway into the room there's this boundary. I suppose they don't want you trampling on some antique carpet or touching some antique piece of furniture or whatever, and so they put this rope boundary in the middle of the room, clearly indicating where you're not allowed, where you must not venture. And similarly then, God has erected boundaries for his human creatures, clearly indicating where morally they must not venture. And by transgression then, Paul means stepping over those boundaries. The word sins, on the other hand, that word contains the idea of failing to meet a standard. So if you're taking an exam, then perhaps you have to get 40% in order to pass the exam. If you're going to pass it at all, you have to get 40%. So that if you end up getting only 1% in that exam, or 20% in that exam, or 39% in that exam, then you have failed to meet the standard. And again, similarly, God has set a standard for his human creatures, a standard which morally they must meet. And this word sin then is referring to the failure to meet that moral standard which God has established. And Paul says then that his readers, both his Ephesian readers and of course us reading it this evening, we used to live in these transgressions and sins. So I suppose it's the kind of phrase that we might use sometimes. We might say that so-and-so lives in squalor. Or we might say that so-and-so lives in luxury. And we're not exactly talking about a geographical environment, are we? But we're talking about the way of life that that person lives in. And so Paul is saying then that this was our way of life, transgressions and sins. Transgressions and sins weren't simply occasional blips in our lives. They weren't simply sporadic eruptions in our lives. We didn't have written on the side of us at that time, may contain traces of transgressions and sins, in the same way that most food products these days say may contain traces of nuts. No, this was the norm. This was our way of life, transgressions and sins. And Paul says then that when that was the case, when we were living in that condition, we were dead. We were dead, he says. Now we need to realize Paul isn't here getting a bit carried away with his prose. I'm sure many of you will have heard of how the American author Mark Twain was once very surprised to read in the New York Journal his own obituary. And he supposedly responded, "The reports of my death are greatly exaggerated." Well, this death report here in verse 1 isn't greatly exaggerated. Paul, as I say, isn't dealing here in kind of hyperbole, in ornate and rather exaggerated language. No, Paul here, I'm sure, has Genesis chapter 2 in mind. Remember how God said to Adam that if you eat of the tree of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, then you will die. And, of course, part of what God meant there in Genesis 2:16 is that Adam would die physically, that his body would stop working. But that can't be all that he meant. Because remember, what he actually says precisely in Genesis 2:16 is that in the day that you eat of that fruit, you will surely die. Now, the day came when Adam did eat the fruit of that tree. But on that day, he didn't die physically. Yes, he did die physically later on as a consequence of eating that fruit. But he didn't die in the day that he ate the fruit. But in another sense, surely, he did die that day. You see, you remember those great words of the Westminster Shorter Catechism. Man's chief end is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. In other words, the great purpose, the great meaning of life is glorifying and enjoying God. The great meaning, the great purpose of life is close and intimate fellowship with God. That's what life is all about. Well, immediately after Adam had eaten the fruit of that tree, in Genesis 3, verse 8, what do we see him doing? We see him hiding from God behind the trees of the garden. And I would suggest to you that that activity in Genesis 3, 8 is so alien to what life was all about. It was so vastly, vastly removed from the whole purpose and meaning of life as God had intended it, that really, Adam wasn't living at all anymore. It wasn't life at all. To be in flight from, to be hiding from the God who is the very goal and center and purpose of life. That's not life. That's death. Adam was still alive physically, but in another sense, there in Genesis 3, he was now dead. And of course, that death he passed on to all his descendants. And that then, as I say, is what Paul is talking about here, I think, in Ephesians 2, verse 1. He's saying that this is what we were. We were dead in that sense. Life is all about enjoying God. And yet we weren't enjoying God one tiny little bit. And so there was no life in us. He's saying that souls and faculties which were created to feast upon the infinite delights of the living God were instead in flight from God and desperately trying to feed on small putrid crumbs of little pleasures that we could get our hands on in this world. And that, Paul is saying, is a living death. We were dead. But then secondly, Paul says, we were dictated. We were dictated. And we were dictated by two different things, or in two different ways. First of all, we were dictated by this age. So he carries on then, you were dead in your transgressions and sins in which you used to live when you followed the ways of this world, as the NIV has it here. But literally it's when you followed the age of this world. Now you can perhaps see why the NIV, and I think the other versions as well, have changed it, because it seems a bit of an awkward and clumsy phrase. You followed the age of this world. But I think that Paul here is saying then that you followed the age of this world rather than, or in opposition to, in contrast to, the age of the world to come. Today I went on the sermons webpage of our church to see if the talk that I gave last week was on the web. Not because I wanted to listen to myself, but because, as you remember if you were here, I recorded it last week and I couldn't really believe that anything that I had done from a technological viewpoint could possibly have succeeded. But it does seem to be up there. And me, technology and me don't really go together all that well, but I suppose I am a bit better than I used to be when I was at university. I think it took about 2 years for me to stop writing essays with a pen, to stop writing them manually. And this wasn't in the dark ages, it was in the late 90s, so it was quite something even then. And I remember I used to try and argue that my position was actually better than other people's, because when it came to exams then, I was in a better position because I was used to writing manually. I didn't need to rely on editing techniques and all the rest of it. And so it was a great advantage to be doing what I was doing. But really, I suppose, I was in a bit of a pathetic situation. There I was. Other people were producing these beautifully written essays, all lovely, wonderfully presented. And there was me with my bottle of Tippex and my smudge prints and all the rest of it. And I was, I suppose, part of an age that was going, part of... I was desperately clinging on to a manual age that was on its way out. And this new age had come in, and I was still clinging on to the old. And that's what Paul is kind of talking about here. That this Christ has brought in this new age. He's brought in the age of the world to come. Of course, it hasn't arrived yet in its fullest sense. The new creation hasn't yet actually being formed. But in Jesus' resurrection, of course, it's kind of begun. And in the outpouring of the Holy Spirit, the Spirit of the age to come, the Spirit who enables people even now to live the lives of the age to come, then in a sense that age is already here. It's within touching distance. It's kind of here already. And yet, here were we, Paul is saying, and we were still being dictated by the old age. The age that is dying, it's on its way out. The age of this world that is going to melt in fire. The age of this world that is doomed to destruction. We're being dictated by an age that is moribund, that is on its way out. That's what Paul is saying, I think, there in that phrase. Dictated by an old age that is passing and doomed and on its way out. But then not only were we dictated by this age, but we were dictated also by the devil. Because that, I think, is who Paul is referring to. In the next part of the verse, he says that we followed the ruler of the kingdom of the air. Now, we don't need to go into the origin of the phrase, the kingdom of the air, but I think it's pretty clear, isn't it, that he's talking there about the devil. And He then goes on, doesn't he, the ruler of the kingdom of the air, the spirit who is now at work in those who are disobedient. So it looks here as though this spirit who is now at work in those who are disobedient is the same person as the ruler of the kingdom of the air. But I don't think that's what Paul is saying. I think by the spirit here, he doesn't mean actually an evil spirit or something like that. I think he simply means the mindset, the attitude, like we talk about the spirit of the age. He means the mindset, the attitude, the disposition, the way of thinking of those who are disobedient. And he's saying then that the devil is the ruler of two things. He's the ruler of the kingdom of the air, and also he's the ruler of this spirit, this attitude, this mindset that exists in those who are disobedient. In other words, he's talking here about a really profound rule, a really profound dictation which the devil had over us. He didn't simply rule us and dictate us in some external physical way, but he actually ruled over the very spirit within us, the very mindset, the very disposition of our hearts. He ruled over us in a very far-reaching sense. You know how there was that term, I think it was coined in the Vietnam War, and then it cropped up again with regard to Iraq and Afghanistan, the phrase hearts and minds, Operation Hearts and Minds, winning the hearts and minds of those in Vietnam or in Iraq or whatever, rather than simply imposing rule upon them in a way that they would reluctantly have to submit to, actually trying to win them over to our rule. And that's the kind of picture here, that the devil had our hearts and minds. He had the spirit within us. In other words, it wasn't that we really wanted to serve God, but reluctantly we went along with the devil's coercion. No, we were clay in his hands. He ruled over the spirit within us. He really did have this profound grip upon us. We were at his beck and call. He would tell us to do things. We weren't aware that he was telling us to do them, but he was telling us to do them, and we would do them because he had our hearts and minds. I suppose there's a point of connection here with what we were talking about last Sunday morning, isn't there? Remember, when preaching on Luke 13, I spoke about how Jesus and his followers in the New Testament, they seem to view reality in much more spiritual terms than we do. So we were talking about that woman in Luke 13, and Luke describes her as having a spirit of weakness. Now, as I pointed out, that woman, I don't think she was demon-possessed. She wasn't ranting and raving. She didn't look like a demon-possessed woman. She was simply an ill woman. She had this form of paralysis, had it for 18 years. It was an ordinary illness. And yet Luke and Jesus in the same passage kind of see it in spiritual terms. And I think we have something here, don't we? That when we were dictated by the devil, it wasn't as if we kind of were demon-possessed and were kind of shouting out things in the middle of the street and acting like madmen. No, we were perhaps very intelligent people, very normal people, very integrated people within society. But Paul here is seeing it in spiritual terms, seeing what was behind our lives at that point. Yes, there was a veneer of normality, a veneer of ordinariness, a veneer of respectability. But in reality, the devil was dictating the spirit within us. So we had this kind of twin dictation, this twin rule going on. This age that is on its way out, the age of this world, not the next world, it was dictating our behaviour. But then also, and to an even more sinister level, the devil was dictating our behaviour too. So we were dead, we were dictated. But thirdly, we were depraved. We were depraved. He continues in verse 3, all of us also lived among them at one time, gratifying the cravings of our sinful nature and following its desires and thoughts. Now again, we haven't really got time. I don't think we probably need in this context to go into what exactly Paul means by the sinful nature. It's the word flesh, really, as I think most of the translations have it. But if you just kind of want to take a shortcut to getting at what Paul is saying here, You only actually have to look kind of one page in my Bible at least back to Galatians chapter 5, where Paul gives us the answer on a plate, doesn't he? In Galatians 5:19, the acts of the sinful nature are obvious: sexual immorality, impurity and debauchery, idolatry and witchcraft, hatred, discord, jealousy, fits of rage, selfish ambition, dissensions, factions and envy, drunkenness, orgies and the like. So those are the acts Paul describes there, the sinful nature. So presumably the desires of the sinful nature are desires in those directions. And those then were the desires that we gratified at that point. And you don't need to be a Puritan, do you, to feel the ugliness of that list in Galatians 5. That it's ugly, it's disgusting. Those are depraved forms of behaviour. And those were the desires that we actively went about gratifying at that point. But you might be thinking, but hang on a minute. There's a lot of very extreme examples that Paul gives in that list in Galatians 5. And we weren't, perhaps, like that before we became Christians. We weren't engaging in sexual immorality. And we weren't engaging in witchcraft. We weren't bowing down to idols. We weren't Christians, but we lived fairly morally upstanding lives. We were fairly decent. And so surely, yeah, perhaps we were dead, perhaps we were dictated, but in this one, Paul's going a bit far. We weren't depraved. We weren't really gratifying those kind of desires that Paul lists there. But that's why it's very interesting that Paul very carefully specifies what he means here, doesn't he? He says that we all of us lived among them at one time, gratifying the cravings of our sinful nature and following its desires, but he doesn't stop there, and thoughts. And thoughts. In other words, Paul is accepting that yes, we didn't all kind of go out and act in these explicitly, outrageously fleshly ways. But he's saying that at least at the level of our thoughts, we gratify the desires of the sinful nature. So going back to that list, sexual immorality, yes, perhaps we didn't act promiscuously. We didn't have one night stands and that kind of thing. But there were, in our thoughts, sexual misdemeanors, fantasies, and indulgence in sexual activity in the mind, which is just removed on a spectrum. It's on the same spectrum, but just a little bit removed from the external act. Or idolatry. Yes, perhaps we didn't go to a temple and make sacrifices, but we just gave ourselves over in our minds to money. That's what really made us tick. That's what we got up for in the morning, making money and doing well and gaining promotions at work. Or hatred. Yeah, we didn't kind of go along to football matches in order to carry out acts of hooliganism, but there was, in our thoughts, a resentment, a deep resentment sometimes, against people who wronged us. And Paul is saying that too, at that level, yes, a more hidden level, yes, a more subtle level, but that too is gratifying the desires of the sinful nature. And so we were all depraved, whether it was an obvious external depravity, or whether it was this depravity that was active in the hidden arena of our thoughts, yet we were all depraved. But then fourthly and finally, we were doomed. We were doomed. He carries on, like the rest, we were by nature objects of wrath. And I suppose that's the most solemn of all the things he says in these three verses. We were by nature objects of wrath. Well, whose wrath is he talking about? Well, it's pretty obvious, isn't it? He's talking about the wrath of God, the one whose boundaries we have stepped over, the one whose standard we have failed to meet. It was his wrath that we were objects of. And that's, of course, what makes it so terrible. Sometimes Talitha gets angry. Sometimes usually something Isaac has done makes her mad. And you can tell just by the way she's kind of flailing her limbs everywhere that she's mad. But it's not a very terrifying spectacle. It's one of those occasions where you have to try not to smile, not to laugh, as she kind of pathetically tries to express her anger. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the anger of the most powerful being that there is. We're talking about the anger of the one who can use any means that he wishes to express that anger and vent that anger. We're talking about the anger of one who, if he wants, can start pulling the universe to pieces around the objects of his anger. The anger of one who has oceans of fire at his disposal into which he can plunge the objects of his anger. We're talking here about the one who is limitless in his potential to express his blessing and favor on the one hand, but also in his potential to express his anger and wrath on the other hand. And Paul is saying that God was against us. He's saying that God was our enemy. He's saying that God had a frown on his face and a sword uplifted in his hand in relationship to us at that point. And again, this may not have been apparent if you looked at our everyday lives. We may have been very happy. We may have been doing very well in this world's terms. Everything may have seemed very rosy, but this was the reality. Behind the scenes, an angry God was standing over us with a sword ready to plunge it down into us. We were children of wrath, Paul says. And you see, it's vital that we're clear on this component, because this is, I suppose, where many Christian, even supposedly evangelical concepts of sin depart, I think, from the biblical concept of sin. Because, yes, many Christians, many evangelical Christians will talk about sin and will include it in their gospel presentation. But it's often this thing which we have kind of, it's the mess that we've created for ourselves. It's this this ruined world around us. It's the ugliness of reality which we have caused by our sin. And too often, it's not this idea of God being against us. Sin causing God to turn against us. And we must have that concept in our presentation of the gospel, because it's the most basic situation the gospel is addressing. That God is against us. We are doomed. We are on our way to hell. We are on the path to everlasting destruction. That's where we were, Paul is saying. We were dead. We had no life, because life is all about enjoying God. We were dictated by this age and by the devil. We were depraved, gratifying fleshly instincts. But worst of all, we were doomed to hell. God was on the brink of casting us into hell. There was nothing between us and that everlasting grave of damnation. And this may seem a very depressing way to lead into prayer this evening. It may seem a rather depressing study. But remember where we began tonight. That we're looking at this in order that we may better be able to answer the question, how significant is it when the Bible says we are saved? Is it mildly significant because we've been saved from some little thing, like the girl who didn't want to read out the poem? Is it really quite significant because we've been saved from some quite serious situation, like the girl who was about to get beaten up by a bully? Or is it very, very significant indeed because we have been saved from a desperate, desperate situation, dead, dictated, depraved and doomed? And Paul's saying, yes, that's the answer. Salvation is very, very significant because of what it is salvation from. And whenever then, tonight we are praying about salvation, whenever on a Sunday we're singing about salvation, whenever in the pulpit I mention salvation, whenever this word salvation comes to our minds, let's never think of it in light terms. It's salvation from this. And let's appreciate it with a very profound appreciation. Amen.